Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of March. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 on the Ideas Network. And our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History, Public Affairs at Princeton University. He does a blog on CNN.com. He's written a number of books, including most pertinent to our discussion at the top of the hour, The Politics of National Security, From World War II to the War on Terrorism. He is also author of Taxing America, Wilbur D. Mills, Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences, Arsenal of Democracy. I already said that. He's written biographies on the presidency of George W. Bush and other presidents. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. We have a lot to talk about today, starting with Afghanistan, where we have horrendous news. I read from today's New York Times. A U.S. Army sergeant methodically killed at least 16 civilians, 9 of them children, in a rural stretch of southern Afghanistan early on Sunday, igniting fears of a new wave of anti-American hostility, Afghan and American officials said. And the lawmakers in Afghanistan have said, "We strongly request the government of America to punish this wild act and have a public trial in front of the people of Afghanistan." It's a big political season as well. There were caucuses in a couple states over the weekend and big contests to come tomorrow. So we will talk about the Republicans and their strategy for winning the presidency and the questions that we've dealt with before on this show, whether or not the president is going to be more liberal in his second term. Professor Zelizer says don't expect that to happen. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And of course, we have lines open. Hour two of our program today, we will be talking about the television series West Wing, which has been off the air for a long time now. But our guest wrote an interesting piece in Vanity Fair saying that particular show inspired a whole generation of young people to be policy wonks, advising some of the most important people in U.S. government. So we will discuss West Wing, the second hour of our program today. I forgot how much I missed that show until I had a chance to see probably way too many episodes over the weekend. So we now have Professor Zelizer with us. Hello, Professor Zelizer. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. This is such a horrendous story. People in Afghanistan, lawmakers are calling for a public trial now. And I would imagine that we're in for a rough road here. There's talk of possible reprisals. What do you think about this horrendous act?
Well, it's horrible, and it's one of the kinds of acts we see as wars drag on. Inevitably, you know, one soldier has the capacity to do something like this that has, you know, really bad political and policy fallout. And so it's caused problems for a war that faded a bit from the public radar just because everyone's talking about the economy and the election here in the United States. But it brings back questions about what exactly the plan is in Afghanistan, what we're doing there, and obviously how long can we sustain support, especially after an incident like this.
Yeah. What about this call for a public trial in front of the people of Afghanistan? Would we ever allow that to happen?
It's hard to imagine, and it's not the kind of thing the United States or the United States military is going to be in favor of, but the call for the trial is a signal of some of the sentiment that could be growing there, where the United States becomes the problem, and there's some kind of demand for accountability about what U.S. troops are doing. So it's a very delicate balance, and it's a difficult situation for the administration to try to calm these tensions.
It comes on the heels of some other horrendous behavior by members of the U.S. military. What's going on? Are people not being screened? Are the conditions creating horrendous conditions for people to live in, and they're going crazy and doing this? Or what the heck is going on?
Well, I mean, it's important to remember this is not a majority of the soldiers, and so we're talking about a few people who do things that have enormous consequences. That's really what's so challenging. Most of the soldiers are not doing anything like this, but the few who do cause really international turmoil through their actions. And part of this is, it's again, it's a phenomenon as war drags on Soldiers are tired. They're beat down. They've been there for a while, living under horrendous conditions themselves, fearful for their lives. And some will take bad actions in the middle of this. War has terrible psychological effects on the soldiers. We know this from Vietnam. We know this from Operation Desert Storm. And now we can see this through Afghanistan.
And now we're seeing polls, Professor Zelizar, showing that 60% of the American people believe that the war in Afghanistan was not worth fighting.
Yes, and if you remember back in 2008, the whole argument from President Obama was that this was the right war, Afghanistan, and Iraq was the wrong war, and that in Afghanistan we went in with the right intentions. We knocked out a regime that had supported al-Qaeda, whereas in Iraq we did the wrong thing based on wrong information and really went after someone we didn't need to. But now the polls are turning on Afghanistan as well. They've always been, fragile at best. And this is something Obama politically will be thinking of, obviously, because this is a war now associated with him as much as President Bush. And if things go poorly, if the public really turns on it, it has consequences for him. But the public is tired of wars without any kind of clarity and where the mission just drags on and the costs remain enormously high.
And when the president thinks politically about this, what's he thinking?
Well, it's the kind of thing that right now is not an enormous problem for him, again, because most Americans are most concerned about the economy. But war can be devastating politically. If things go bad, they really can go bad. And he saw this firsthand as the Iraq War helped bring down George Bush's presidency in terms of approval ratings and helped drag down John McCain, who couldn't remove himself or free himself from the Republican support for that war. So this is something he has to deal with. He has to make sure that public anger is mollified and that he offers the public some sense of where this is going. The public does not like ambiguity when it comes to war. They want to know with some precision what we're trying to do and by when we're going to do it. And I think you'll have to offer Americans something like that.
Let's talk about the presidential race. You wrote not all that long ago, I'm trying to see what the date is on this, February 20th, the outcome of the election of 2012 is becoming even tougher to predict since there are many political landmines facing both parties. You write about the Republicans and Mitt Romney remaining the front runner, though barely. Has that changed significantly since you wrote that?
It changed. It's gone through some ups and downs. I mean, Romney's been a campaign that is primarily focused on the math, as we're hearing, meaning he has a long-run view of how to get enough delegates rather than focusing on the polls in any given week. I do think Rick Santorum clearly presented a much stronger challenge than he ever expected and was able to continue with his momentum much longer than Romney certainly had hoped for. And so because of the ongoing feud within the Republican Party, there's more instability, and it's having some impact on his standing, though Romney remains the front runner and continues to draw on many assets, including his ability to raise a lot of campaign funds. For President Obama, there's an uncertainty as well. I mean, he's doing better now. But this is a fragile economy, the international situation, not on national security so much as on economics with Europe, is very unstable. And if there's any big swing in terms of the condition of European finances, that could have big consequences in the fall. And we're also waiting to see what the Supreme Court says on health care. So there's all these things out there that we know are coming in the next few months and can have really a big impact on the election, swinging things in one direction or the other.
And going to another part of the world where there's a potential for an international crisis, you write about Iran and the tensions keep escalating. It could go, politics could move in one direction or another, and who knows what Israel's going to do. This could be a potential crisis for this administration.
Absolutely. The administration is keeping a close eye on Iran. The Republicans have already made this a theme in some of their campaigns. And you have the unpredictable nature of what Iran itself is going to do, and added to that, Israel's own fears about Iran, not just with nuclear weapons, but missiles, which pose a threat to the country. And so Whenever you have an international crisis where the regime you're dealing with is unstable and where there's a third party involved, here, mean Israel, it's a very difficult challenge. Right now, it's still a potential threat. It's not like when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1980 or after 9/11, where there was something immediate that Americans were worried about. This is still about potential. So I think it's out there, but I still don't think it's on the front of most people's attention.
Let's talk, before we go to phone calls, a little bit about the Republican emphasis on social issues in this primary campaign. I think at some point you said it's a loser for them.
It always is. Social issues are attractive for some Republicans. They have seen it since 1980 as a way to potentially attract working and middle-class Americans whose economic interests clearly rest with the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. But the argument was, on social and cultural issues, many more conservative Democrats might flip. And Rick Santorum this year has bet a lot on that. He's pushed himself and he's pushed his party to deal with social issues, ranging from contraception to gay rights. But the fact is, Republicans tend to be off on those polls, meaning where social conservatives are is not where most of the country is. And not only does the public not support a lot of those issues, but they tend to alienate key constituencies like women. So I think Republicans, that was a big change in the last few weeks, entered into this dangerous game rather than focusing on economics, where Obama remains vulnerable, looking at social issues, where in fact the Republicans remain much more vulnerable.
And it would appear that they're having a significant problem with female voters.
They are. The polls are registering this, everything from Rush Limbaugh's comments to some of the comments of people like Santorum. There is indication that many female voters in the Republican Party, women moderates, are not happy with what they're hearing. And then in some cases, Santorum is fulfilling some of the caricatures that exist of what the GOP is about. So, this election started, the campaign started with Mitt Romney being ambitious and hoping to win over voters in swing states, independents, moderates. But if the party primaries push him and push his party further to the right, I don't think he'll be able to do that.
We're seeing, as you know, a little bit of improvement in the economy. You mentioned the international situation and who knows what direction that's going to go. Are there any indications that this improvement will continue? And if it does, what would it do to the Republicans taking on the economy as the primary issue?
Well, it can continue. It's unclear how fast it will continue. I mean, we're dealing both with a recession, but also with deep structural problems in the economy, where many Americans have been hurting even when times were good, with jobs going overseas, with the kind of economic security Americans once had in the 1950s and 60s, now a fleeting thing, with certain kinds of benefits no longer a sure thing for most American workers. Those problems will not dissipate in 2 months or 3 months. They will be there come fall. And given the severity of the economic crisis we've been in since 2008, the pace of improvement is good right now, but it's not going to be great. So clearly it poses a challenge. If Republicans want to make an argument that Obama has not improved the economy, if the economy is improving, that argument doesn't sound so convincing. If Republicans focus on the deeper problems in the economy and try to talk to Americans about how Democrats don't really address this, that would give them more of an opportunity, I think, to keep this an issue that's a winning issue for them.
Two phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer. We'll take them in just a moment. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books, and of a valuable blog on CNN.com, where he writes every week about pressing issues. We have yet to get to how the president would govern should he be reelected. Professor Zelizer has said that he really is a pragmatic centrist to the core. What does he mean about that? What's the evidence of that? We'll talk about that as we continue this hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Julie Weiner will join us, a blogger and contributing writer for Vanity Fair, who has an interesting piece in the current issue, West Wing Babies. She argues that, I can't believe it's been 6 years since that show has been off the air, but it continues to have, she says, a huge influence on young people in politics. So we'll talk about West Wing, hour two of our show. Two-year phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer. Our first caller is Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
How are you doing this morning?
All right. How are you?
Oh, I can't complain too much.
Good.
I just had a few thoughts about this current state of our military and Afghanistan. I just got back from Afghanistan about 4 weeks ago. And you hear about the Quran burnings and this admittedly horrific killing spree that the sergeant supposedly went on. And I feel obligated to point out that it is not only the vast majority of the military, but all but the half dozen of people that are actually directly involved in these things that condemn them as completely horrible.
Right.
And that goes on, though, to think that we've been over in Afghanistan for 10.5 years now. So we have these young sergeants. They were 10, 11, 12 years old when the towers got hit, and they've lived their entire adult life and most of their formative adolescence thinking of these people as the enemy.
Did you, when you were there, Eric, feel any sense of progress, that you could see something happening that was good in Afghanistan?
I hate to say it, but the most recurring thought I had is looking around at the different bases I was at and what's been going on. The one thought I had is, and we've been here 10 years.
Mm.
I can't believe that we've spent a decade and this is what we've accomplished.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts about how this person should be punished? Because it obviously is going to have a huge impact. We can sense it happening right today as we speak.
My thoughts on how he should be punished, it should be done either under the UCMJ, Universal Code of Military Justice, by the American government, and or at The Hague, under the purview of the UN. If you start allowing individual nations to press charges against military members, I mean, that's just... That opens up a whole can of worms and sets a precedent. There's a reason that we have the UN. There's a reason that we have an international governing body for situations like this.
Mm-hmm. Professor Zelizer, start with 10 years. That's a long time.
It's a long time, and I mean, I think the two points that he made, which are accurate, the first, that this is really a small number, very small number of military soldiers who we're talking about. This is not the majority. The unfortunate thing is, given how war works and given how the modern media works, any incident by one person, flares very quickly and has enormous consequences and starts to define perceptions of what the military is doing, even if most of the military condemns this and really, which they do. And so it's the kind of problem that isn't fair, but is a problem that the military and the United States have to deal with. And in this region of the world, it's kind of doubly important because there's a perception of what the U.S. military is trying to do and what it's about and that it can't be trusted. So I think he is right, and I think it's still a problem that has to be dealt with. The enormity of time that we have been there is phenomenal, and we don't think of this as a long war. I think many Americans, because there's no draft and because, you know, public attention span is very limited, isn't thinking about how long the soldiers have been there, how much of the life of many people has been lived in this region of the world and with this very difficult problem. And as a result of that, there's less political pressure, I think, to do much about the war, to have some kind of clarity and argument from those who conduct it about what we're doing. But it is a long war now, and it's been a very costly one.
What has the president said about when the troops are coming home? Is it 2014?
I believe so, although there's always some ambiguity. about, you know, exactly when that will happen and kind of what that means, you know, what kind of troop levels will be left there after the withdrawal takes place. But theoretically, we are supposed to be, you know, entering into the drawdown of this war very soon.
Thank you, Eric, so much for calling us. It's good, I'm sure, for you to be home. Brad in Whiting. Hi, Brad.
Notice how none of the Republican candidates are talking about taking us back to the good old days when W was in the White House. Pretty much everything George Bush touched, he trashed, kind of the opposite of the Midas touch, whether it be the economy, foreign affairs, education, environment, global warming, alternative energy, Katrina, Medicare, borrowing money from China to pay for tax cuts for the rich. Could go on and on. So I'd be surprised if people would be willing to pick another Republican president, seeing as his track record was pretty much a failure.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the opinion of many opponents of the GOP. That's the hope of many Democrats that the legacy and consequences of the last Republican administration are great, and that in some ways they overwhelm the chances of the party to rebuild itself right now. That said, you know, parties go through terrible moments. They go through unpopular presidencies. They go through moments when the policies of the party are really under criticism, and they rebuild. In 1964, Barry Goldwater, the Republican senator from Arizona, is devastated by Lyndon Johnson, seen as pushing the party too much to the right, seen as an extremist, and seen as basically burying the GOP. In 1968, Richard Nixon, a Republican, defeats Hubert Humphrey. So parties can rebuild themselves, and the public can be forgiving and doesn't always connect what current candidates are doing and saying with what the previous president has done. So parties are more nimble, I think, than we remember.
And thank you, Brad, for your call. Our number, some lines are open now, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political with one of our favorite guests, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books. His latest is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. It's interesting to me how our appetite for resources seems to tie in with a lot of this, because we have heard reports that there are certain types of resources in Afghanistan, and that also that Afghanistan could provide a transit point through which pipelines could go. And we have 2% of the population of the world, but we consume 20% of the world's oil. And just in church yesterday, I was hearing about how in the ideal world, we'd use things and we love people. But in actuality, a lot of times we love things and use people. And I think that is manifest in our foreign policy. The Saudis were the ones that were mainly the perpetrators in relation to 9-1-1. And yet we go on this lie that we tell ourselves that we can have unlimited oil on the cheap. And you know, and what we do to other people in the process doesn't seem to matter, and so we have people like Gingrich who manifest themselves as lie babies, saying that we should have 250 a gallon oil, which is ridiculous, and you know, it's just an epic example of what goes around comes around, and we're suffering tremendous consequences in trying to constantly expand our empire and chewing up our resources and the resources of the world in the process.
That is an argument that has been around for a long time. You heard Jimmy Carter make this argument, that ultimately foreign policy rested on our ability to reform energy policy, and that unless we came more independent, unless we used resources differently and used different kinds of resources, we would forever be caught in the quicksand of areas like the Middle East and elsewhere, where our need for resources often at least drives part of policy. It's not the only reason we're there. There are many reasons, geopolitical reasons, but that's one of them. The problem is energy policy is never a very popular topic. When presidents have tried to deal with it, like Jimmy Carter, they have failed. And they found that even members of their own party don't really support the kind of bold initiatives that would be needed to transform how we use our resources. So we are locked in this problem, and we are constantly engaged in parts of the world because of domestic practices, not just international threats.
Thank you so much, Jim. As always, nice to hear from you, usually on Monday mornings. You wrote a really interesting piece recently, Professor Zelizer, about second terms and whether or not, as claimed by many, the president would move significantly to the left and become a much more liberal president. You write, despite the Republican claims about his being a big government liberal, the truth of the matter, is that he is a pragmatist centrist to the core. Why do you say that?
Well, in terms of Obama, just look at his first term. He is much more like Bill Clinton than Lyndon Johnson. On most of his big initiatives, he's forced liberals within his own party to accept pretty big compromises. His health care program didn't include a public option. It didn't include a lot of the kinds of cost controls that many people thought were essential if we're really going to tame how our health care system works. And it relied on state governments to administer these health care exchanges that will be central to the program. That's a pretty kind of moderate solution if you compare it to what Harry Truman called for in the 1940s, or even what Senator Ted Kennedy was calling for in the 70s, a kind of single-payer system run through the government. In terms of the economy, he did push forth a big stimulus, but it was a lot smaller than most liberals thought was necessary. And even on financial reform, his record's mixed. He kind of moved to a middle-of-the-road solution, and he continued many of President Bush's policies, ranging from TARP to the war on terrorism. So he is not a radical Democrat. That's an argument that Republicans have been making since 2008, but it doesn't really square with the record. And so it's unlikely that he's going to change that much in a second term. If anything, I think history shows he would be forced or under a lot of pressure to move even more to the center and to really focus on protecting what he's built rather than on building new things.
Mm. You also are a professor of history, and you've written widely about other presidents. You mentioned second terms of Woodrow Wilson, Harry Truman, Bill Clinton. What historically have those Democratic presidents done? Have they become more liberal in their second terms?
Not at all. Maybe in terms of their rhetoric, but not in terms of their policy. Most of the Democratic presidents since Woodrow Wilson have all passed their major initiatives, most of their big-ticket items in their first term, whether you're talking about Roosevelt and the Wagner Act and Social Security, both coming in 1935 during his first term. Lyndon Johnson obviously only has one term, but the evidence was a second one would be much diminished. Bill Clinton tries health care in 1993, and after that, you know, really focuses on issues like welfare reform, V-chips, and reducing the deficit. Harry Truman also backs down even after he's reelected in response to kind of threats of anti-communism and growing conservatism. So there's many examples where presidents push back for a variety of reasons, but there aren't any Democratic presidents who are bolder in their second term than they were in their first. So that's an added reason to at least be skeptical about warnings that if he's reelected, he's going to be able to push, or he will even want to push, some kind of huge, bold legislative agenda.
And yet he seems to be speaking a little bolder these days, doesn't he?
Well, he's speaking bolder. That's part of just election politics. And Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, his rhetoric became much more strident as he faced third-party challenges from the left. And he talked in much more populist language. But after he was reelected and then he faced kind of growing congressional pressure after he tries to increase the size of the Supreme Court, he pulls back on almost all his major domestic policies. So we have to separate campaign rhetoric from what's probably going to happen.
We have been through all kinds of primaries. We have more coming up. We've had some caucuses over the weekend. What are your predictions about what's going to happen in the South? And do you predict that Newt Gingrich is anywhere near saying that he's going to throw in the towel so it can be a Santorum-Romney race?
It's hard for Newt Gingrich to do that. He's a political creature who doesn't like to lose, and he doesn't like to concede defeat. And I think there's part of him that truly believes he's on a mission to save the Republican Party. And it's going to be hard for him to do that. Part of him, though, knows that's the only way Santorum even has a chance of posing a challenge or bringing this into the summer and putting some pressure on Romney in the selection of a vice presidential candidate. I think it will depend. The one thing that can cause him to step down is humiliation. And if he starts to lose to Santorum in these southern states and maybe to Romney in one of them, like Mississippi, I think that could be enough to get Gingrich to step down, not because of the good of the party, but because he doesn't want to be defeated anymore. I don't know what's going to happen in the southern states. The analysts say the best chance Romney has is Mississippi, in part because there's a strong Republican machine there, and a machine can deliver votes even if voters aren't particularly enthusiastic about the candidate. But Romney doesn't have to win all of them. He's playing a game, as we said, about math. And he's doing a little bit of what Obama did in 2008. He's focusing on the delegate count right now, not simply kind of trying to win hearts and minds. And he's ahead, and as long as he keeps winning enough, that's all he needs to take himself to the nomination.
When you look at that delegate count, it does appear that he's doing okay, doesn't it?
He is doing okay, and he's probably about where he expected to be. Obviously, he hoped to have wrapped it up after Super Tuesday, but he's still in good position, and it's still very hard for either of these other two challenges to somehow defeat him. So he's doing okay. It's not great. It's not overwhelming, but all he needs right now is the nomination. He can focus on the campaign in some ways in the fall. And that's a different kind of game. That's a different kind of challenge. And so he's doing, it's to be. But that's all he needs right now.
Yeah. Do you think Rush Limbaugh is going to lose his job?
I don't know. This controversy seems worse than some of the others he's gone through, although he's gone through many and he seems to survive. I don't know what his numbers are in terms of his revenue that he brings in to his bosses. I assume that's the ultimate sign that they will look at in terms of whether to fire him. But I think he did cross a line here. And, you know, I think when you say things that even have huge ramifications politically for the party you're affiliated with, it could be a sign that he has lost a little bit of control over the kinds of things he's saying. But clearly there was a harshness and crassness to this comment that will cause some to think, why do we keep him on the air at all?
And how closely aligned would you say he is with the Republican Party and Republican candidates for some years with his show?
Well, he was in the 90s very closely aligned, and we know there was coordination between Republicans in Congress and him and other talk show hosts in terms of sending out certain messages and trying to coordinate themes for a week or even for the day in terms of what the Republicans were looking at. He's also been hugely influential in terms of, you know, stimulating voters and getting certain ideas out there through his radio show. Now I don't know how closely aligned he is. There is no kind of Republican establishment anymore. There's a bit of chaos going on. But he's an important voice still for the right. And he really helped to master and pioneer talk radio and integrate it into right-wing politics in a way that few others were able to do. And I think his voice still carries weight. And it also carries weight in a negative way. When he does something that crosses the line, he can alienate voters from the GOP.
And his success, I think, has influenced so many stations all over the country to do similar kinds of programs, actually, to make sure they're doing conservative talk as well. I don't think you can overstate his importance.
It was huge. I mean, the conservatives in the 1970s were really determined to help impact the media and to help impact public debate. And they felt that liberals had dominated the airwaves, they had dominated the universities, and they were on a very conscious mission to try to use first talk radio and then cable television and now the internet as instruments to change the debate, to shift things to the right. And I think he really did that quite well in terms of his impact. Whether you like him or don't like him, it's hard to ignore that. And many have mimicked him, and many stations need a Rush on their station or some version of that. And I think, you know, conservative talk radio is part of the heart and soul of talk radio right now, and he was a big factor behind that for better or worse.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, and we're welcoming phone calls. We have so much to talk about international news with the horrendous events in Afghanistan over the weekend. We're in the middle of caucuses and primaries, and we've been covering those pretty thoroughly. And looking at the president, what a second term may be like, the economy, etc. He's one of our favorite guests because he can comment and go from topic to topic quite flawlessly, as you might have heard. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. His website is Julian Zelizer, Z-E-L-I-Z-E-R, that is, .com. Author of a number of presidential books and other books as well. His latest book is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He's the author of Taxing America, Wilbur D. Mills, Congress and the State. Arsenal of Democracy, big book for him, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and many others. Here's our phone number. One line is open if you'd like to grab it, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You're also welcome to send an email, and that address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we will focus our attention on Afghanistan, what has been accomplished after our long time being there, and we'll pay, of course, special attention to the horrendous events of the weekend in that country. So I hope you will listen. And we're going to talk about West Wing. I found an article in Vanity Fair, a young woman who says that so many young people, and I had never heard this before, were inspired to go into the wonky world of political operatives because of West Wing, the long-running show. It was on the air for 6 years. I thought it was a terrific show, and many people still reference that program, so we'll talk about it. Also, the HBO, I don't know how many of you have cable and saw the HBO show on Sarah Palin over the weekend. We'll look at the influence of those kinds of programs, and I think there's a Veep show coming up on HBO in just a little while. All right, two more phone calls. Roz in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm calling in regard to the situation in Afghanistan. I have felt for some time that the U.S. is trying to do something that is not doable over there when they talk about establishing a democratic government. The realities of that part of the world are not unlike the realities of Saudi Arabia before King Abdulaziz conquered it all in the early in the last century. They are a very tribal culture, and in tribal cultures like that, you're not going to establish democracies, but because historically, from biblical times, places like that have been controlled and ruled by the elders in a particular tribe, and the central governments have been of very little influence. And for us to try to transform it democracy is emerged that evolved in Europe after the nation states were established to my mind futile.
Professor.
Yeah, this has been the argument against Iraq, against Afghanistan, that we're going into a region with very weak traditions of democracy, with huge ethnic conflict, and in some cases very weak central states, central governments, such as in Afghanistan, and that we're basically on a hopeless mission. So that is the argument. The supporters of these kinds of initiatives argue it is possible in the modern day and age to create not American democracy, but some more democratic forms of governance than what existed. And, so far, I guess you can say it's unresolved. Iraq was left in a very precarious state, certainly more democratic than when it started, and with more democratic structures for governance than when it started, but still imminently unstable. Afghanistan right now looks much messier and less hopeful that they will be able to achieve that. The second part of that is how many resources are we willing to really put into this project? I think everyone would agree, if there's even a chance to democratize some of these regions and to create some kind of stable democratic institution, that's going to require a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of human resource. And it's unclear that the United States really has the stomach for that. The first part of the mission was just to knock out the regime that existed. That was easier. The second part, the rebuilding, is extraordinarily hard, and it's unclear the United States really will continue with this in Afghanistan, and might leave as much of a mess as when we started.
And we go to Jean from Ashland. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I don't know whether everybody's been told not to talk about this, but what about the people who are on contract military operations? They were called Blackwater, but then they changed their name to something else, but nobody says anything about them. There were supposed to be more, even more of them than our military, U.S. military, who were visible, but the others were invisible. What about them? Are they coming home? Did they disperse? Will they just stay there? What?
That's a good question. One of the big phenomena that we saw in recent times is the privatization of the military. And in the kind of post-draft era and in the post-Vietnam era, one of the solutions was to hire some people to do this job. And not talking about professional soldiers, but actual contractors. And in Iraq, that had often very negative consequences because the contractors were not bound by U.S. military rules. They were often unsupervised. And they often got in the kinds of scandals we've been talking about today. And again, even though they were private, they still created a really bad image for the United States. I don't know what happens. It's going to depend on kind of which contractors we're talking about. I assume certain would stay. That is one way in which the rebuilding can continue, through the government paying third parties to do it rather than having the military do it themselves. But I haven't really heard, in terms of a specific plan, I'm not sure it's out there, what happens with the contractors working in Afghanistan.
And we go to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Thank you. I can't listen to all the media all the time, but I never hear what the Republican leadership is saying in regards to the Afghanistan incidents or the contradictions of the Pakistan ruling government and so forth. Do you hear what does Boehner or Cantor or Mitch McConnell or any of the GOP candidates other than Paul have to say about the incidents, the recent incidents in the Mideast, and what we're supposed to do there? Where is the GOP stance on these issues?
Well, I know that Newt Gingrich made some comments the other day, maybe on CBS News, I'm not sure, where he was critical of Afghanistan, and he says that it's basically a war that we aren't going to be able to win, and that we're not willing to put the kind of commitments there that we wanted. He also condemned the shooting and said it contradicted American values and gave a really bad image. In general, I think the Republicans have been wary of being too critical of Afghanistan. This has been one area of bipartisan support, but both in Congress and with the Republican candidates in the primaries. Generally, they have been critical sometimes of the conduct of the war, the implementation of the war, but this, is, after all, is a war that started under George Bush and which Republicans have voted in favor of repeatedly over the years. So I don't know if an incident like this causes more fissures within the GOP. Gingrich's comments were the most negative that I had seen, especially since in recent days Gingrich has been really ramping up the national security arguments that Obama's weak on defense. So I assume there'll be more criticism forthcoming as a result of this.
And thank you so much, Steve, for your call. A couple lines open, 800-486-8655. Jane in Green Bay. Hi, Jane.
Hi. This is back to the Rush Limbaugh thing. I just got home from Saudi Arabia last night visiting friends. I love their media. But anyway, Al Jazeera had an extended piece on the Rush Limbaugh incident, and Clear Channel owns Rush Limbaugh stations, and Bain Capital owns Clear Channel, and Mitt Romney owns Bain Capital. So it seems to me if Mitt Romney had any conscience at all, he could shut Rush Limbaugh up or tone him down significantly if he wanted to.
Well, those are a lot of connections. I'm not sure Romney really would have the authority to do that, and that would be quite a story if that came out. Often we see these kinds of connections, but the reality is different personalities and different figures are disconnected, and there's less coordination than we think of. The world is much messier than it appears, and certainly that's the case here. And I don't think Romney has the kind of authority to get Rush fired right now, nor would he want to enter into that kind of a story.
Well, I don't think Mitt Romney has much courage either, and nor do the other Republicans, because Rush Limbaugh has been a huge problem in many, many ways, and he just goes on and on and on.
Did you say you really like the media in Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely.
Why?
I can get CBC and a French station, all in English, and it's much more broad-based. You get very, very many points of view, and I'm a person that likes to get a lot of points of view and make up my own mind rather than having someone's. Because ABC, CBS, and NBC, they more or less spout the same thing.
You do get a lot of the same news when you watch the nightly news. It's true.
Right, right. One channel is the same as the other, and these are very varied and many, many points of view, and you can get Russian channels in English, and it's amazing.
I never thought about the media in Saudi Arabia. Have you, Professor Zelizer?
I haven't, although, you know, it is remarkable. If you want the access to different media you have right now, certainly through the Internet,
right,
and even to some extent during cable. I'm not sure many Americans want to take advantage of it like this listener, so they tend to kind of veer just to a handful of stations, which you're right, you know, revolve around one or two major news stories. But the Internet, I mean, one interesting thing about it is it has vastly opened the potential for gaining access to many different kinds of positions and voices on our news, and it's a matter of trying to get people to engage that.
Right, and it can just take so much of your time, can't it? The thing is, you go to one source and you think, oh, I could go to this source and that source and that source, and you can just spend your day looking at all the sources that there are.
It can be overwhelming, and so I think for many, they just end up picking, you know, one or two things they trust and watching that. And obviously, the cost is you don't get the kind of variety and nuance you would from sampling what different countries are saying and different kinds of media are saying about comparable events.
Right. Well, welcome home, Jane. Thanks so much for the call. Willie in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Quickly, I just wanted to remember that Richard Holbrooke died some time ago, and he was a major international sort of ambassador to the area. And they said that among his last words were, we've got to get ourselves out of Afghanistan. And I was sort of thinking back ways in distant history, and I wonder, you know, we don't seem to ever learn anything, because those were very probably amongst the last words of Alexander the Great, too.
Yes, look, people have been warning about Afghanistan, both Democrats and Republicans, for a while. And many people have been concerned that this is a war that won't have the same kind of impact as Vietnam simply because of how it's being fought and the absence of a draft here, but that would drain us and that would continue to involve us in a way that made it hard to get out, to really get out. And we'll see if Obama follows through on the withdrawal. But we often ignore what happens in previous wars. We do that all the time. Why we do that, I don't know. But policymakers, kind of, they are aware of what happened in the past, but they think they have a solution that will be different. And sometimes they have no choice. You know, they're driven by crisis. They are humans living in very frightening times often, and they make bad choices. But you are correct. And with Afghanistan, we've seen warnings go unheeded, and it's unclear, you know, what the game plan is other than this potential withdrawal. But we don't know the future of the country, which is just as important.
Thank you so much, Willie, for the call. And thank you, Professor Zelizer. We always love having you on the air. You just rapid fire on so many issues. It's impressive. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest this hour. His latest book is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, has written a number of presidential books, A History of Jimmy Carter's Presidency, A History of the Reagan Revolution, and The Presidency of George W. Bush. He also is the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and a number of other books. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We have news coming up, and we'll return. Stay with us.